You are now listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, where the worlds of sports medicine and performance collide. My name is Mike Quintons. I'm a physical therapist with an entrepreneurial mindset that specializes in treating orthopedic and sports injuries. I'm bringing on the brightest and sharpest in the field of sports medicine to share their best practices and explore the gap where medicine meets performance. What's happening, Performance Therapy Nation? This is Mike Quintons, your host of the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. Today, we have a special but not so special guest who's been my co-host over this entire season, Rob Rubina, the Director of Strength and Conditioning at Ivy Rehab in Newtown Square. Quick bio on Rob. I feel like this is long overdue. Rob was the Director of Sports Performance for 9 years at Ascent Athlete. Rob is an adjunct professor at Widener University, Doctor of Physical Therapy Program, and Cabrini University, RIP. Rob is a fitness consultant for Altus Movement Technologies and has published research on conditioning for baseball. Rob has an MS in exercise science and completed an internship at Cressy Sports Performance in Boston, Massachusetts, and has enjoyed the opportunity to present at multiple NSCA events. Rob has now been with Ivy Rehab for how long now?
Year and a half.
Yeah. So far, so good, man. It's been amazing just to see how much influence you've had on not only the clinic, but the company and the territory. So today's a special session where it's just Rob and I, and we got a little Q&A. And these are frequent questions that I feel like we field all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, now time to flex a little bit and give you guys the answers that you're looking for. So let's get into it. Arm care. What is done right? What is done wrong? Maybe let's start with what's being done wrong first.
What is arm care, Mike?
You give me the definition. You're the expert.
Arm care. So I feel like if you're trying to take care of your shoulder elbow as a thrower or overhead athlete, there's a lot of steps I feel like you have to take in order to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure that our clients and athletes are staying healthy. So steps that I like to take to keep shoulders and elbows healthy is, like, first and foremost, let's make sure we have adequate joint range of motion. We want to make sure our internal rotation, external rotation, shoulder flexion, abduction, all our shoulder measures are adequate and good, right? If one of those is lacking, that's something that we're going to star and come back to and try to improve in our exercise program.
And outside, sorry to interject, but those measures are taken, should be taken in the beginning, right? At the time of arrival, right?
Correct.
They should be taken, just like you do in your assessments, correct, like I do in mine.
Correct.
So we do have normative data relative, correct, to when they showed up healthy.
Correct. That's our baseline. So we need to establish a baseline of, like, what their joint is able to do. And from there, we want to make sure that the shoulder can move appropriately. If the shoulder cannot move appropriately, we're going to see compensations in our movement during exercise. We're going to see compensations when we throw baseball. So that's a really big one for me. After we have adequate range of motion, we want to start to strengthen, in quotations, the muscles around the shoulder, the rotator cuff, serratus, lower trap. So there's lots of ways we can strengthen the shoulder. You could do traditional external rotation isometric exercises. Usually like to start off supine, prone, if someone's having some issues, progressing to more side lying, and then like throwing specific positions, half kneeling, standing split stance, where I use the word strengthening, like that we're not strengthening, we're doing a body weight exercise. So we're not really lifting weights, so that is strengthening the rotator cuff is something that I would do. And then I like to do a lot of rhythmic stabilizations or random isometric based exercises. Things that kind of fall into that category are really any kettlebell bottoms up. So any kettlebell that you're holding bottoms up forces your shoulder to stabilize the arm in the socket. And I think that's really like the true function of the rotator cuff and the surrounding muscles, is to like keep the humerus in the socket at all times in all various positions. So that's like what the rotator cuff's function is. The textbook might say internal rotation, external rotate, internally rotate, externally rotate the arm, but its real function is like keep the arm center in the joint at all times.
Yeah, it's fighting the deltoids, right? So the deltoids help to ascend or elevate,
yep,
the humerus and the head of the humerus. And that's when you're going to get, different throwing patterns and compensation and so forth. And what Rob's talking about, just to clarify, you have different positions like supine and prone, right, on your back, on your stomach, kneeling and then standing, and then also progression of where the elbow is, right? So we call it abduction,
or elevation of the shoulder, where instead of doing exercises with your elbow by your side, now you're starting to load the rotators, internal and external rotators, primarily external rotators, and with the arm up in a throwing position, like you said. So I love the progressions, love the description of everything. What's the volume like?
Yeah, right? So when you are programming or trying to keep your shoulder healthy, I do believe it's really best to implement it into your exercise or strength conditioning routine. So, you know, making sure that we have one or two, maybe three exercises a day, depending on who the athlete is, you know, what their range of motion is, what their goals are, where they're at in their season. So that'll all those factors dictate like how much volume we're doing. You know, I would say typically we'll do 2 to 3 sets of most rotator cuff exercises. And again, those are paired with other upper body or lower body exercises. So we're, you know, always using the shoulder and rotator cuff exercise and surrounding muscles during push-ups, during rows, you know, during a heavy deadlift where we have our arm at our side holding heavy weights. So that's kind of how I would program it, is like into your exercise routine, you know, 1 to 2, maybe 3 exercises a day. Always continuing to monitor how we're feeling, always continuing to monitor our range of motion, and always continuing to monitor our workload to make sure that we're feeling good and playing at a high level.
Yeah, and with the monitoring then comes adjustments, right? So it's not going to be the same exercises every time. And you said 2 to 3, what's that, 5 to 10 minutes, right?
Yeah,
right. So anyone who's taking 30, 45 minutes to do their arm care every day is probably doing a little too much. So in terms of volume, but nonetheless, I mean, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of baseball players have a lot of like throwing like arm care routines.
Right.
The arm care routines are good, have a place. I do agree, like most of them are probably overdone. And I really think you could choose 5 exercises for your quote unquote arm care routine to do daily. If again, you're like probably more of a high level thrower, college pro level, you know, that's a great thing to do to, again, check all your boxes to make sure you're doing everything you possibly can to keep your shoulder healthy, performing at a high level. But I think all in all, like having a good arm care routine really goes a long way in keeping you on the field and playing at a high level.
And I'm okay with throwers doing arm care, well, pitchers in particular, even the day after they have a, you know, they pitch or they have a bullpen session. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be an everyday thing. It's just modified as mm-hmm. you go. All right, let's quickly talk about what's usually done wrong. And we've seen a handful of shoulders come in from all over the place over the last few weeks. And I think a lot of it has to do with strength conditioning
yeah.
and the programs that they're doing on their own, not necessarily even their volume of throwing
yep.
seems to be strength conditioning. So yep. touch base on that. Well, you know, without getting the blood pressure up. That's the goal today, baby. But I'm curious your take on, for strength conditioning coaches who are programming for college teams, for high school yeah. teams, for pro teams even, what is being done wrong that is leading to some of these overloading issues that we're seeing in season?
The first and foremost thing that's not being done is just there's no rotator cuff exercises in the exercise program.
Right.
So then whose job is it to keep these quote-unquote healthy players on the field? Like, the job of a strength coach is to keep players available and performing at a high level. So the high-level part is easy. We lift weights. We move fast. The available part is doing the things that help mitigate the risk of injury. And for baseball players, that's doing rotator cuff exercises. So it has to be in your strength program. Has to be. And I'm not talking about a couple sets of band external rotations. That's not enough. And that's not training the high performing shoulder either. You know, that might be something you do for 50-year-old Susie who's coming off rotator cuff surgery.
Right.
Right. But not for the high performing thrower. That's not gonna, you know, stress the shoulder enough in training so that stress on the field is low.
Yeah, and I'm going to add one more thing onto this. Like, we've seen a couple guys come in with like bench pressing the day before they throw, and yeah. it's like 5 or 6 sets of 3, 4, 2 reps. Like, it yeah. just doesn't, you know, we can get into the bench press thing another time, but it just doesn't make sense to me to be, you know, let's do high intensity exercises,
yeah.
especially those kinds of lifts,
yeah.
You know, in the middle of the season.
Yep. No, right? Yeah. In season training for baseball, you know, we want to, like there's research that baseball players lose certain range of motion during the season after they throw. So we have to understand that and then apply that to our strength conditioning program, understand our in-season conditioning, what that should be like, understand what a thrower goes through in a game, what they should do after, You know, we have to really understand the demands of the sport. So then the strength and conditioning coach can help prepare it and continue to keep the player available and on the field. So the strength coach in season, we're not going to be doing high volume lifts. We don't need to, because their high volume on the field is high. They're throwing every day. So making sure that increasing our deadlift in season, like, doesn't matter.
Thank you. Completely agree. I'm going to move on from arm care. I think we nailed that one. Let's pivot over to ACL. So a study came out in 2022. In the show notes, I will post the article itself, or a link to the article, but found this in the conclusion. It's interesting. Recent evidence suggests that more than 50% of athletes are unable to return to their pre-injury level of function after ACL reconstruction. And between 50 to 100% develop knee osteoarthritis within 5 to 10 years of surgery. In your opinion, Rob, when returning from ACL injury, where do these go wrong?
I believe that most post-ACL athletes assume that the therapist returned them to play, but didn't return to like the high performance athlete that they were before. And that's not to say that PTs do a bad job with return to play. It's to say that like they got them back to maybe baseline, but not to like the high performer athlete that they need and should be. So I feel like essentially they just were not doing strength and conditioning and or weren't doing a good S&C program to continue the development after the ACL surgery.
Yeah, there's two pieces to this that, you know, I can't wait to dive into, having gone through a couple of these procedures. Number one is insurance companies pay physical therapists to get the patient back to function, not to performance. Those are different things, right? We have to realize that. So function is, you know, not even changing direction, right? Like it's getting up and down the steps. It's getting in and out of a chair. Yep. It's being able to walk a certain distance, right? It's not necessarily competition. So I think PTs have this internal struggle. I'll speak for myself. I have this internal struggle where I want to get them ready for competition because I feel like I can do that. But then I have to stay in my lane and know when they are at a point where I'm doing strength and conditioning with the patient at this point. That's not my job, right? And nor will insurance pay for that. You know, that'll catch up to you. So having a good strength conditioning coach is key to this. A lot of these tears are happening after they're discharged from physical therapy. Having spoken to a handful of high-level, top-notch ACL surgeons in the area, that's what's happening. So it's after they're out of the care of a PT. And then the second part of this is, what is, if you're discharging the patient and you don't have a strength conditioning coach to send them to, or they're not going to a strength conditioning coach, it's our responsibility as physical therapists to make sure that they have an appropriate home exercise program that can be progressed. A patient can come in, you know, at 7-8 months for a recap or a review of their program, and then you update it, right? Like, that is part of what we do. It's beyond just our time in the clinic together. It's the home exercise program. So do you have any tips for our listeners that they should be, you know, looking for or doing after, you know, they're discharged from PT, whether it's like plyometrics or like things that they can keep up with to make sure that they're doing something after rehab? Because once rehab is over, you're right, athletes return to competition and they return to practice and they think that's enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially like the teenage female that mm-hmm. we're seeing, like, mm-hmm. like 30% revision rate is wild after, you know, 6 to 10 months. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, simple answer. I just don't think people are loading and lifting enough weights. They might just assume that, like, I'm just going to go for a run. Most of these probably are soccer, lacrosse, maybe female athletes that, like, they probably have never been to a gym before, Mike. They don't know how to lift weights. I think real simply, like, my advice is to find a good strength coach, lift some weights, and in that strength program, hopefully it's including good change of direction, good agility, good single leg hopping variations, and then good single leg strengthening. I think most people just aren't strong enough and they can't decelerate and they can't change direction. And again, when your body's not prepared to handle those stressors of sport, bad things happen.
The tear happened for a reason, right? So, I mean, as PTs, we try to correct that movement pattern, but the reality is those movement patterns happen at higher velocities and intensities, and volume plays a role, fatigue, et cetera. That's in the research. So it's not necessarily realistic to think that we can correct those movement patterns when the athlete is at that specific level of fatigue, right? So I think that's something to consider. Yeah. I think the other thing is, like, listen, take some ownership on this, right? Like, talk to your surgeon. If you don't have a strength coach, ask your surgeon for a strength coach, right? Ask for a recommendation on, who is there someone you have in mind that I should see now that I'm done physical therapy?
Yep.
Right? I think that's why aren't we asking that question? Like, what's next? Yes, we're clear of the play, but that's not the end game.
No.
You know, it's sustainability of it. So, and correcting those movement patterns with training. So, yep. I'm happy we hit that. That's a big one. All right, Rob, let's move into programming. This is something that I feel like this is like you're going to just throw around some gems here, and everyone should listen to this, especially if you're involved, whether you're an athlete or a strength conditioning coach. So, program design. I got like a fast five for you.
Oh, I'm ready.
All right, superset versus doing single exercises.
Single exercises, but both are good. Both are good. Both have a place. The advantages to doing like a single exercise and not supersetting, I would probably program that if we're chasing like maximal strength and if we're chasing like maximal power or rate of force production. Like you need to rest so you can produce either force quickly or force slowly, which is strength or power. The advantages to doing supersetting is we are able to accomplish other things along with getting stronger, along with getting faster. So for example, if we're limited in range of motion, we could superset a bench press with a hip mobility exercise, right? So we're accomplishing other qualities that are required or are our goals to meet. And if you continue to do more supersets, if we do three exercises in a row, if we do four exercises in a row, understand that like each exercise is not going to be maximized because we're going to be fatigued. We're going to be tired from doing exercises in a row. So doing multiple exercises in a row, like three, four, or five exercises, is probably recommended for someone who is maybe trying to lose some weight, put on a little muscle, maybe a little bit of both, burn some calories. So all ways to program are appropriate. You just need to understand like what the person's goals are and what you're trying to accomplish when programming that, each of those styles.
Yeah, I mean, I think the term used often is active recovery, right? So if you're, you know, pairing exercises and a superset, you have a core lift, like a deadlift, for example, yep. And to do, you know, another core lift with that does not make any sense, right? So
no.
So the key is to pair with an active recovery. So Rob said it perfectly, a hip mobility exercise with, you know, a core exercise would make perfect sense. Yep. And you went upper body, lower body on that tandem, yep. Right? And it can be two upper body, two lower body. Right. But the point is that it's active recovery. It's a lower intensity right. exercise that you're prescribing with the core exercise.
Right.
All right. So number two, how often do you program for less than four reps in a particular set?
Not very often.
And I'm sure that the intention of that would be depending on what the goals are of
right.
that
individual. I would say the only time I program under four reps would be for more like single arm, single leg assistance lifts, i.e. like a dead bug. Don't do like four aside, three aside. Mainly because sometimes if you have high repetitions, the quality and exercise technique goes out the window because the client or athlete has to do six, eight aside. So that just takes too long. Quality goes out the window. So in those scenarios, I'll program 4 to 3 reps, which would be like, according to the textbook, traditional like strength ranges. So a lot of times that can be confusing for someone new to program design. But, oh, well, like it's under six, so I'm training strength. Well, yes and no. You're also just like making them think about like doing a dumbbell reverse lunge, how long you have the muscles under tension. So if you do 8 a leg on a dumbbell reverse lunge, that's a lot. You're going to be doing that exercise for a long time.
Just thinking that
right? exercise. So like even though 8 reps again would be under like the hypertrophy rep range, I'll sometimes program 3 to 4 to 5 a leg on a single leg lunge variation because it just takes too long and form goes out the window, technique goes out the window. So those are the scenarios where I would program that like 3 to 4. Very rarely do I do like a heavy deadlift for 2 reps. I don't really think we need to be maximally lifting 1 to 2 reps. The main reason is I do not trust most people's technique with heavy loads, and I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze.
Testing's one thing, right? Training's another. Yep. So I love that answer, and I completely agree with you. All right, so this is big picture programming. So when you're putting together a program, how important is it to you in every session that the program includes for that day includes a variation in major movements? And when I say major movements or movement patterns, I mean a hinge, a squat, a push, a press, a pull, a carry, a crawl, core.
Yeah, I think that is probably the easiest way to write an exercise program is to follow those kind of quote unquote movements. It just really kind of provides you a template, and it provides enough variability for the athlete or client to accomplish whatever their goals are. So I think it's important to try to get most people to do some type of squat variation, to do some type of hinge variation, to do some type of a lunge variation, right? There's always something that they can do within that pattern that will, I've done like band assisted high split squat lunge iso holds with like someone that's 72 years old and has like knee arthritis and it feels great. And I've done the opposite end of that, SSB rear foot elevated, you know, split squat lunges, right, with a eccentric. So there's always variations along the progression regression, you know, line or ladder that you can get someone to do a movement with.
All right. So along the same lines, how about different planes of movement, right? So sagittal will be forward and back, frontal will be side to side, transverse would be across those planes, right? Yep. Like a diagonal or some kind of a press and push or a press and pull.
Yep.
How often do you include different planes? And is that like a necessity for you that you involve different planes in your programming?
That's a great question, Mike. Yes, I do think it's important. I also think, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, I also think most people's idea of frontal plane isn't actually frontal plane.
Yeah, it's almost impossible, really.
I don't really want to get into the weeds of the frontal plane discussion, but I do think it's important to provide people movement options, i.e. working in different planes, doing different things, providing different loads, cables, dumbbells, body weight. I'm a big believer in that. I'm not a huge guy. I'm just like, let's just bench, squat, deadlift, and clean, all with the barbell.
So I'm going to give you guys a quick example so you understand what we're saying here. Box squat, barbell box squat. If another exercise in that program is a split squat or a reverse lunge, those would be in the same plane, right? So maybe you incorporate a clock lunge or a lateral lunge combination with that. Would that make sense to you? If you're going to put that, not necessarily pair them together, don't pair them together, but in the same program.
Yeah.
Different plane, right? Go like a lateral lunge.
Yeah. I think like most people think frontal plane is just like the lateral lunge, lateral lunge step outs, skater jumps, hide ins. Then your sagittal plane exercises are your, most exercises are sagittal plane, Mike.
Right.
Most fall into that category. The whole plane discussion, again, like you're always controlling frontal plane doing a dumbbell offset reverse lunge.
Right.
So again, like I don't want to get too deep in the weeds with the frontal plane stuff.
It's impossible, same one plane, right?
I think at the end of the day, like let's get people doing a lot of different things, give them movement options so that when they have to reach their arm up to the top shelf or throw a baseball 100 miles an hour, they're ready to do that.
And the number five would be then stance positions, right? Whether you're doing a squat or you're doing a split squat, right? So how much are half kneeling, right? Prone, supine. How much is stance relative in your programs?
I think stance is a great way to progress exercises. For example, a dead bug is supine or on their back. That's a low-level core exercise. Progressing to like a prone bear hold or a plank. Like you're now prone in a different position. Plank's a little bit harder than a dead bug. Progressing to something maybe tall kneeling or half kneeling. So now we're a little more upright. Have to learn to control those same positions in a more upright posture. Then progressing to more standing or standing split stance posture. Again, where you're on your feet. Again, making it more challenging to control your center of mass and your trunk during a basic core exercise. So you can follow that basic line of progression to provide the person a safe progression to more advanced exercises.
Yeah, so when you're, after the first 4 weeks, you're looking at weeks, 5 to 8, it's a great opportunity to take an exercise and modify the stance, and that's enough of a modification.
Yep.
Nah, I love it, man. Those are a lot of gems right there. So let's move on to the next thing. These are two quick hitters. Name one thing you've changed your mind about during your professional career.
This is such a great question.
One thing.
Did you come up with this?
This
is so great.
No, I think you did, actually. Dude, I'd change one thing a week. I
don't know where to start with this one, Mike. I'm going to give two answers. Can I give two?
This one time.
All right. One answer is going to be like with exercises. So like, I think that exercise used to suck. And then I changed my mind on it. And this might be a little controversial. I don't know. But early on in my career, I was a big hater of the leg extension. I thought the leg extension sucked.
I feel like we were trained, at least I can speak for PTs.
I thought it sucked. It wasn't good.
We were trained to hate that exercise.
It wasn't a good exercise. I told people not to do it.
How do you feel about it now?
And now I think there's a time and place for it. So I think that's definitely something that I changed my mind on, over the years. And that kind of coincides with like the machines too. Like early on in my career, I was like, oh, machines suck. Don't do machines. They're bad for you. They don't require any stabilization. Don't do them. And now I'm like, maybe there's sometimes I would recommend machines.
Sure.
I'm
with you.
Machines have a time and place. So I think that's like something that I've changed my mind on over the years is like every exercise has a time and place. So understand that and program accordingly.
Love it. I'm going to give mine manual therapy. versus exercise. This might light some people up. Man, I've really prided myself on my manual therapy skills and still do. But I found that sometimes I can create a dependency of the patient on manual therapy because it feels good, but not see much carryover. And I think some of it has to do with ego. You know, I feel like I'm in a confessional right now or something like that. Okay. But but some of it is ego. It's like, I can fix them with my hands. You know, they feel great when they come off the table. But you're not loading any tissue, right? And that's something I've really come around on, that manual therapy is very important. I think patients see value in it. I think there's legitimate objective value in manual therapy and in various type and forms of it, manual therapy. But when it comes to getting people better, returning to function, the issue more often than not, a lot more often than not, is not manual therapy. You know, that's not going to address it. It's the tissue's ability to tolerate a load, right? And in different planes and movements and so forth. So yeah, listen, do the manual therapy because the patient values it and because it's going to get them feeling better and moving better before they begin their exercise program or even self-mobilizations, however you want to do it. We don't have to get into different models of like 20, seeing 20 a day versus 10 a day and the challenges with manual therapy and those types of heavier models. But nonetheless, there's a place for manual therapy. Definitely give it the kudos it deserves, but it's not going to fix patients. It just isn't.
Well said.
All right, last one here. One piece of advice, I get this all the time. One piece of advice, only one this time, for a student physical therapist or an aspiring student physical therapist. And I think we can, depending on what your answer is, this may go across, you know, to strength conditioning coaches.
You go first, Mike.
Oh, man.
You go first.
This is a tough one. One piece of advice. All right. Set yourself up when you get out of school and even while you're in school. Use that opportunity while you're in school to absorb as much as you can, as many different things as you can. Shadow PT, shadow strength conditioning coaches. Don't only shadow the profession you're going into, but the professions you're going to be working with, I would say, are just as important, right? So learn as much as you can. And listen, don't chase $1,000 here and there, guys. Like, I'm so tired of like, oh, if it was $1,000 more, I would have signed with you. What are you missing out on? Where are you going to be 5 years from now, right? 10 years from now. I got out of school. I did my residency program right away because I knew I didn't want to do any more academics down the line. So got it over and done with, learned a ton, applied it to my practice, shadowed a PT for 200 hours who taught me a ton of soft tissue techniques and different ways to examine patients. So I'm going to get off my horse now and hand this off to you. But learn as much as you can, as soon as you can, while you're in school, and have a plan for when you get out of school, regardless of the dollar bills. Go with the opportunity that's going to put you in a better position 5 to 10 years from now to really make the moves you want to make. Don't be so short-sighted in where your first occupation is or where your first job is. So, yeah, there you go. You got it.
Good one. Mine would be, so if you're a student PT that wants to work with athletes in this type of setting, all right, my recommendation would be to go learn how to coach exercises, because, and Mike can attest to this, you are not taught how to coach during PT school, okay? And understanding the coaching aspect of what a strength conditioning coach does or a trainer provides you real value in not only coordinating with a strength coach and then coaching your clients through their exercise program. You know, so finding ways to get coaching hours under your belt. I don't care if you go to the LA Fitness, Mike, and you're coaching 45-year-old moms to lose weight. There's value in that. So go get some coaching hours under your belt as an SPT. Coach on the weekends. I don't care when it is. Go coach people.
And the same goes to other fields too, guys. Like if you're into neuro and you want to be working with strokes and brain injuries, like go find out how those PTs and other professionals, occupational therapists, speech pathologists, how they work with those patients. And that way you can take in some of that, because there's principles that carry over across different professions. And I see it with my strength, that what I do with my patients, right? I superset all exercises. I use different planes of motion. It's different exercises, maybe more coordination or recruitment or activation, and not the same kind of loading you're doing with your clients, but it's a different time in their recovery, right? So the principles that I would use as a strength conditioning coach, I apply to my patient's programming. Like it's a program. It's not do 3 sets of 10 of straight leg raises and 3 sets of 10 of bridges and it'll move on to the next thing. Pair exercises up that are working different muscle groups that are gonna, you know, gain more function. So yeah, man, I think these are great pearls here. You got anything else you want to add?
That's all I got.
Great session, man. That's a wrap.
Thanks for listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. If you like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It would mean so much to me if you could leave us a 5-star review so more listeners like you could get this important information. See you next time.